Good morning. So last time covered multi-level page tables. So this was where we said, well, having a single array for our page table representation in memory, that's not actually going to be very good when we have these large address spaces. So instead, we decided to have this very fat tree-like data structure. So very fat in that, like, it's a tree, but unlike your normal binary trees like you've seen, it's very, very, very wide. And we have, in fact, multiple tables which have a very similar structure to our single level, single array, and each of those tables is kind of a node of this tree. So we have our sort of our base pointer, and it points to an array, which is our first level page table, and that points to some number of sort of second level tables, which each point to potentially, some number of levels until we get to the actual data. And I'll put a and to look up in this, we take our virtual page number, which we split up our address into after we remove the part which says where in a page we are, and we split that up into pieces. We start with the most significant piece, and we use that to tell where we are in this first level table. Then once we've done that, we'll get a pointer to a second level table. We'll use the next part of the virtual page number to tell where we are in that. And we'll keep going until we get finally to the last level of our page tables. The number of levels, it depends just sort of on a choice the processor makes when they decide how are you going to divide up addresses. And when we get to the last level, we'll finally sort of have a pointer to an actual page with not nor page tables, but actual data that the program might care about or code that the program might care about. We also briefly mentioned this idea of allocate on demand or swapping, that we kind of gave page tables as this idea that the OS would set up a page table, it would run your program, and then it was done dealing with the page tables. But in practice, that's very often not what happens. And in particular, one thing we can do is we can not actually set up the page table completely and still run the program. And you'll say, well, the program's gonna crash then, right? Well, it's not gonna crash, it's gonna trigger an exception. And even though probably the most visible thing to you as a programmer who's dealt with buggy C code that happens on an exception is your program crashing, the OS doesn't have to do that and very often won't do that for the exception triggered by there's some memory that the program accessed wasn't set up in the page table. It can instead set up that memory and then restart the program, having it retry the instruction that triggered the exception, and making it work this time. And using this, we can do things like sort of not set up an entire big stack all at once. We can just wait until the program actually needs more stack space before we actually set up that extra memory. Or we can, for example, not load all of the program from disk. We can just load part of it and wait until later on when the program actually tries to use the rest to load the rest of it if needed. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay. And I have some slides for the quiz. And looking at the quiz, I will go over question 4. We can talk about the other questions if people want me to. So question 4, we had this scenario where our programs where we were executing an instruction that copied from a particular virtual address into a register. We know it's a virtual address because when we're running normal programs, all the addresses the program tries to use are going to be virtual addresses. We don't ever let the program use physical addresses directly. Or else, we're trying to defeat the point of setting up a page table and trying to keep it from accessing things it's not supposed to, and like giving it the illusion it has its own memory. So we have this virtual address, and we were told we did a first level page table lookup, and we went to a particular address, and we could have figured out that that address was based on the first part of our virtual page number times the page table entry size, which was 8, plus the base address. But we didn't actually need to do that. The question was asking that, you know, what happened in the next level? And we were told we read a page table entry, which was valid, had this physical page number. So we wanted to figure out where the next level page table entry is. So my mechanism for solving this, as I said, we had this physical page number for the second level page table. So let's figure out where the second level page table starts. Well, I need to add back in a page offset. It happened that our page offsets were 12 bits. So I added 12 bits of zeros to turn this physical page number into a physical address. And we were going to look up this index, 0x1a2. So I need to go to that element of the array that started at that location. And each page table entry was 8 bytes. So I went to index 1a2 times 8. Questions on how I computed that? Or other questions about the quiz? Okay, so I'm going to switch this one and then this one. Okay, so as I said last time, this is going to be exam review. So I will take all your questions about the exam. I'm going to try to take basically most of the questions all at once, and then I'll get to answering them. So what do we want to ask about or know about? Yes? Do you think there's something wrong with the key for the quiz for which question? So try reloading question one, reloading the quiz, because I fixed that just before lecture. It was 2K sensitive about the quiz being. Otherwise, submit a regrade, or we'll have some TAs look at it and figure out if there's answers which didn't match, where the key was like too picky, like requesting lowercase when we didn't really want to do that. Or like requesting OX when we didn't really have to do that. Yes? So tell me what the problem's about and which problem, and we'll get to that.
It's the fall 2021 final, problem 11 through
8.
It's like a pipeline problem.
Okay. Other things people want me to talk about? So loading vectors and the caches, okay. Like virtual memory? With virtual memory?
It's not to do with virtual memory, just like tracing through memory and seeing like when an instruction is executed, what goes into memory and at what bytes.
Okay. So assembly and memory check. Okay. Yeah. Which is about caches? Caching? Okay. Other things you want to talk about? Yeah?
Can you talk about what about the AVX stuff we need to do?
Okay. Anything else? Yes. So the question is retrying instructions, so you mean like with exceptions?
Yeah, like if there's an exception and instead of crashing the program, you want to retry the instruction?
So exceptions in pipelines?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other topics? Yes. Okay. So let me try to order these by some order. Group those together. Pipeline we'll put there. Okay. So I need to pull up the final to do this. The old final. So question 1B. Okay, so we'll start with question 3B. Okay. So in question 3B, we had a contents of memory, and we were told that we have easier not to. Okay, so I should move this over here. Okay. So we were told that RBX, RBX contains OX800, RCX contains OX1234567 8. And we're running the instruction LEA, OX5, RBX, RBX, 3B. I should read the problem correctly. So RAX is OX100 for this problem. Answering different. 5, 6, 7, 8. And we were running RM, move Q, RCX, 10, RAX. And the question is, what are the values at OX1FF, OX11, OX1017 after this? And we were told in the question what the original values are. So let's think of what this instruction does. So this instruction is going to, we have, if you remember, AT&T syntax assembly. So we always know that our last operand is our destination. And also that the sort of the base, or I should say the displacement then base syntax means access memory at displacement plus base. So we're going to compute a memory address by taking OX10 plus RAX, which is going to be equal to OX10 plus OX1000 because of the information in the question. 1010 is the memory address we write to. And the value we write, right, is OX1234567 8. And the amount we write, well, there's two ways we could have known this. So one is that this B represents quad is 8 bytes. Another way we could have known it is that this is a YD6 instruction, and YD6 only does things with 8 bytes. Doesn't have anything which works in smaller units. Another way we could have known it is that RCX is a 64-bit register, an 8-byte register. So the amount we write is 8 bytes from all that reason. It gives us all the same answer. So we have to think of how do we write 8 bytes when I'm given a single value and a single memory address, and where each memory address represents one byte. So we'll modify addresses 0x1000 through 0x1007 inclusive. Or sorry, 1010, because I am reading the number I wrote, through 1017x inclusive. So those are the addresses we'll modify. Because that's 8 bytes. And at 0x1010, we have to figure out which part of the number do we put there. And this is going to be, because we have little endian on our systems, that's always what we have for y86 and x86. So this implies that the least significant byte goes to the lowest address. So 0x1have is going to have the least significant byte of 0x1234567 8. The least significant byte of that is going to be the ones place. So that's going to be 0x78, ones place. And then we'll have the next least significant part, which is going to be 5, 6. Then 3, 4. Then 1, 2. And we still have stuff we need to write because we have an 8-byte number. And so I think what confuses a lot of people here is the value we write is this, but it's still an 8-byte value, which is an 8-byte value because it's in RCX. So even though I didn't write it out with, sort of all the bytes for being very explicit about it, we know because it's in RCX, we're using 8 bytes to store this. So RCX must store some leading zeros. Because we're going to, RCX is 8 bytes, we can't make it smaller just because we're storing a smaller value inside it. So the remaining bytes are going to be 0. And in the question, we were asked for the value at 0x1011 and the value at 0x1017 and also the value at 0x100F. The value at 100F didn't change, so we just looked up the previous value and we found from what was written the two new values for 11 and 17. Changed. Questions about that answer? Okay, so then we're asked about 11B, which is about pipelining. And okay. So for 11B, we were executing this, executing this sequence of instructions. I guess I should get a setup of the problem first. So we have a pipeline processor with 7 stages, which are fetch, decode, execute 1, execute 2, memory 1, memory 2, write back. And we're running the following set of instructions. The question is, how many cycles of stalling were needed? And the thing we want to pay attention to is dependencies here. So So dependencies we have, because these are things which might require us to wait. So dependencies, these might require us to wait depending on how the pipeline works out. And that's, well, we have R11 from sub Q to R move Q, sort of written by sub Q and read by R move Q. We have R13 written by NQ and read by the another R move Q first. And those are the dependencies I notice. I don't see other dependencies, even though we have some registers in common, because we're just reading the older value. So if we've done stalling for that, presumably it's we would say it's part of earlier instructions. And also, if we look at this, the code in detail, there's all the instructions that produce the values of, say, R9 and R12, for example, you know, should have had plenty of time. Should have had time to get there. Maybe not. With forwarding, I should say. Should have had time to get there. So then we can look at our pipeline diagram for these. So we have fetch, decode, execute one, execute two, memory one, memory two, write back. And we can just, I'll just do the pipeline, assuming we don't need to do any stalling, and then I'll check our dependencies and see, do we have a problem? And then we have the rent. Okay, so this dependency, so the value of R11 is available in, I'll just do some numbers here, so 0, 1, 2, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Available in cycle, sort of available at end of cycle 3, which is in time for R move Q's, which is equal to the end of R move Q, the first one's decode. So there's no problem. No problem. So I guess to be more specific, so we'll forward it to decode and solve the problem. And we'll find out that something similar is true for R13 and the second R move Q. So these dependencies in here are seem fine. So we get none from these dependencies. So zero from these dependencies. But there's sort of two other sources of stalling you might be worried about. So one is that if we look at the assembly R9 used by sub Q is computed by addQ. Is computed by an earlier addQ. And the assembly for this looks like so this is a dependency, but the addQ will have fetched a bunch of mispredicted instructions before we end up after the JLE, or I should say during the JLE. So there's a long time. So the add queue will be out of the pipeline by the time the sub queue reads R9. So there's no, so don't actually have a hazard there. And there's another bite, you might say, which is that doesn't ret, after ret, we can't figure out what instruction to run next. And isn't that part of running the ret? And we, on the exam, we accepted two interpretations. Interpretation one is that the skull for ret was part of the next instruction. The next instruction, so zero cycles of stalling. Or the stall for ret was part of the ret, and that stall took 5 cycles because we have fetch. Two right back, and we'll actually fetch the right thing here, so we will waste 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 cycles before we can fetch the right thing instead of 0. Okay, so questions? How I figure it out? That example. Okay, so then I'm going down the list. I'll label this pipeline diagram. So then we had a question about, so someone asked, how does loading vectors work with caches? So when we do a sort of vector load that's contiguous, the ones we've seen in the assignment, the lab, etc., are just a big cache read. So rather than, e.g., reading 256 bits instead of 64 bits, but work the same way as a 256-bit read. So I guess things that might be and confusing here, I guess, is, so one thing is that, you might say, but the vector has multiple elements. Don't we need to read them separately? Assuming they're all together in the cache, no. We can just read them all at once, and processors that support vector instructions will have caches that support extra wide reads for this reason. So something else that you might be wondering about with vectors is, what if the vector crosses 2 cache blocks? And that can certainly happen. So if the value we are reading is split across 2 cache blocks, then the processor needs to somehow turn this into 2 cache accesses. But this also happens with non-vector reads. Reads, e.g., if you're reading a 60, e.g., reading in this 8-byte integer that starts 4 bytes before the end of the cache block. And that is slower, but it still works. So other questions about vector loads, since I'm not sure exactly what people loading vectors and caches, I'm not sure exactly what it was. Okay, so then last final one B. So this is saying we had an L1, so we had a system with an L1 and L2 cache. And the L1 cache, relevantly for this problem, had a write back, write allocate policy. L2 cache also had a write back, write allocate policy. What else is relevant? And cache, and both had the same block size. Yeah. So that's also going to be useful. They both have the same block size. We were at, this question asked a bunch of things about when a value is written to the L1, which of these could happen. So we had one. So another value, the same index bits, but different tag bits, will be written to the L2. So that was one possibility, and this is yes, and the reason for this is that we could need to replace, so writing a value to the L1 will allocate a block for that value. Allocating a block for that value might require evicting a previously stored block. That previously stored block might be dirty because it's write back. Write back, and so we need to write it. And if so, so we need to update the next level of cache. And I guess a way you could reason about this is you could say, we're writing it, we have this write allocate decision, like our two possibilities for that are we allocate a new block or it's already in the cache. If it's already in the cache, we can kind of quickly eliminate that we should write anything else. And then we say, if we're allocating a new block, how, you know, could that cause us to write anything? We should just generally think when we're evicting something, write back means we might write something, not write back means we shouldn't, we will discard something, but we won't send it to the next level because the next level is already up to date. And then another possibility was another value with these same index bits, but different tag bits will be written to main memory. And this is yes, because when we write to the L2 cache, the same thing could happen as in one. And I should do thing in one could happen in the L2. And that would cause it to write to main memory. Three. And then we had that value, the one written to the L1. Also written to the L2, and this is no because of the write back policy. We're going to wait as long as possible to do that. Another is that value is written to main memory, is also written to main memory, and this is no for the same reason. Then, had another value with these same tag bits, but different index bits written to the L2. And we can eliminate this, and 2, and the same thing then for 6 for main memory. And this is, we can eliminate this because we will only, we'll never evict values with the same index. So we'll only evict values with the same index bits because sort of each set of the cache works independently. Right? What happens in one set generally doesn't affect another set of the cache. So the other thing was that the same thing for main memory. So this might be a bit confusing. So this is, the answer here is no, but it's a little trickier. So we know that the L2 cache might evict something which has the same index bits in the L2 cache. But will it have the same index bits in the, which has, right, evict something. Yeah, I should say, yes. So the question is, could that thing have the same tag bits but different index bits? And I guess we need to go back here to option 2. So we knew it was possible for it to have the same index bits and different tag bits, so why is that the case? So something that I kind of just assumed but didn't actually write down is that it turns out that the L1 cache has sort of a 16 kilobyte four-way, 64-byte blocks, which means that we have 16 divided by 4 kilobytes. Or 6 index bits. Bits and 6 offset bits. And the L2 cache is 512 kilobytes, 8-way, 64-byte blocks, which means we're going to have more than 6 index bits. We could compute the exact number, which is going to be 512, 4 divided by 8, should be 10 index bits, assuming I did my quick math correctly. So for 2, the reason why I could say that is true, that it will be in the same set in the L2, which means that it could have all the same index bits. Same set in the L2, and it's possible that something which shares index bits in the L1 also shares all the index bits in the L2. So that was possible because even though it's something from the same set in the L2, some of those same sets have the same index bits. Some of those values in the same set have the same index bits, even though not all of them might, because there are more index bits. For this, so we're asking, could that thing have the same tag bits, but different index bits. It's looking at the L1. And if the L1's tag bits are all the same, then this means that the L2 tag bits are all the same. because the L2 has less tag bits than the L1. One. And that means that we'd be asking sort of the same question as 5. So this is still the same scenario as 5. It's 5. And in fact, scenario 2 is the one where we have to be a little careful about, you know, it's possible for scenario 2 to happen, but it won't always happen, because sometimes the index bits in the L2 that are not shared with the L1 will differ, sometimes they won't. Or not will differ. Sometimes the index bits that sometimes the index bits will all be shared in the L2. So the index bits will all be shared in the L2, so that's not a problem here. So it's possible that someone shares the index bits. It's not just possible, but something that shares the index bits in the L1 also shares, could also share all the index bits. Yeah, it's possible. Sometimes one shares, so. And this is, questions about that? I think I will. Is it? Yeah. Can I explain? Re-explain? Can I re-explain if the L1's tag bits are all the same? So the question is, the L1 tags are all the same, this means the L2 tags are all the same. So probably a good way of dealing with the what's happening in the L2, how does that relate to the L1, is if we look at the address being split, we have our address is split into, we have a tag, we have sort of a tag part, and then an index part, and then an offset part. And the offset is always is the same size for both caches. So that is fine. But the L1, being a smaller cache, has fewer index bits than the So this is kind of the layout we have of the of addresses, how they're split for the two caches. So our L1 has fewer index bits than our L2. So a value, so if a value has the same index in the L1, then it may or may not have the same index in the L2. So if two addresses have same index in L1, may or may not in L2. If two addresses have the same tag in the L1, same tag in the L1 is the what's in the question. So same tag in L2, may or may not in L1, but the other way around, if they have the same tag in the L1, they must in the L2. Same in L2 because of the subsets. Is that clarify or questions? So this is what's going on with the addresses, and this is how we can think about how does this relate to the L2 when the L2 is evicting something from a set. Like, is it the same set in the L1 or not? We can see, like, do the index bits match? What do they tell us? Other questions? Comments, follow-ups? Okay. then what AVX stuff we expect you to know. So we don't expect you to know the names of any instruction or intrinsic names. We may ask about we're going to ask about whether code is easy, hard to vectorize. We might give you the names, descriptions of intrinsics, of instructions or intrinsics, and expect you to use them or understand how they're used. Yes. Sure. Okay, we'll add that to the a queue for the end. Quiz 14. We'll take another round of questions after I get through this set. So that's other things on AVX stuff we expect you to know. Okay, so then asking about exceptions and pipelines. So we didn't talk about this. So we didn't really talk about how exceptions interact with pipelines or out of order. Generally, when an exception occurs, the processor should choose an instruction to stop at, and cancel the operations or undo the operations of everything after that instruction, after that instruction. So the processor is going to choose, this is the instruction that where the exception occurred, and we're going to, that's the one we're stopping just before. We're going to cancel everything, add it after it. Then the processor will run the OS. So if we're thinking of our pipeline, anything that was in the pipeline from after in the normal program is going to have to be sort of somehow removed from the pipeline before the OS gets to run. And this same thing applies with out of order, but in out of order it's more complicated because we might need to undo some later instructions, operations. And that is something that out of order processors do, and it's in fact what a lot of the machinery in out of order processors is dedicated to making possible, is that when we have an exception happen, that even though we might have executed 50 instructions ahead of where that is supposed to have occurred, we need to undo all of those 50 instructions before we start the OS. So the OS sees it as if none of those things happened. So questions on exceptions and pipelines? Yes. So the question is, how does rerunning the instruction work with this? So if the OS jumps back to the instruction that we stopped at, that should run with the same register values, etc., that it originally had, unless the OS changed any things. So this lets the OS retry instructions in that way. The processor is going to do a lot of work to make it easy for the OS to retry instructions, generally. And I would say, as I said, we didn't really talk about this, so it's not going to be the exam, I hope, unless I made a mistake. So this idea of doing this is called, known by the name, precise exceptions. There's a term you'll see in the literature. And as that term might suggest, there's a scheme where you don't do this, and some processors implemented it, and people quickly discovered that it is very not nice to write OSs on systems which don't have precise exceptions. So pretty much every processor out there implements this precise exception idea where it stops at a particular instruction no matter what really was happening under the hood. Okay, so that's round one of questions. So I'll take a second set of topics since we have more time. So we already had quiz 14, question one on vectorization. Other things you would like me to talk about? Okay, so not really. Pull up quiz 14. So quiz 14, I can actually do have these options. So quiz 14, we were given these options. And we were asked, so was which of these can we vectorize easily? Or no, it was which of these would benefit from a load vector load instruction that rather than taking one address and loading a bunch of things from there takes a vector of pointers and loads from each of those pointers. Loads one thing from each of those pointers. So what we want to look for here are cases where, you know, we'd like a way of loading things that aren't right next to each other when we think of how we're going to vectorize this. And the question noted that the load vector of pointers instruction is going to be slower than the sort of load from one load a bunch of things with one from bunch from one pointer. And it makes sense it would be slower because it's a lot more complicated of an instruction. With the load a bunch of things, we're telling the cache, here's an address. With the other one, we're somehow telling the cache, here's eight different addresses, figure it out. And there are processors which have the machinery to do this kind of efficiently, but it's still a lot more complicated. You might have to access a whole different bunch of different cache sets. You might have to access the same cache set multiple times. It's, you know, a lot of work to make fast. So a way of thinking about this is like, let's look at how we would vectorize this. So our sort of first step in vectorization, so to vectorize this, I'm going to try doing multiple I at a time. So that's going to give me, so what I'm going to end up doing here is this, but I'm going to change this to, like, let's say we have vectors of four things. I'm going to change this to do four at a time. And it would look something like this. Three, four. So like I'd expand it like this, and I can do each of the ads with one vector add instruction. Sort of each of the ads vertically with one vector add instruction. So if I like look going down, I have a bunch of add operations which are all the same. I can make that a vector add instruction. And the values I want to load in vectors to do this are ai plus 0 through ai plus 3, bi minus 1 through bi plus 2, bi plus 0 through plus 3, bi plus 1 through bi plus 4, which are all contiguous. I can use the load a bunch of things from one address operation to do that. So I don't think there's any like particular thing that cries out that load is going to be insufficient, you might say. Though maybe I want to figure out a way of loading from B, fewer times because the loads overlap. But I could do that with sort of shuffling instructions. So I have instructions that move values around in vectors, in registers. So if I have instructions that move things around in registers, maybe it would be more efficient for me to like load from B twice and then move values around so I don't have to like load three times to get overlapping things. Something like that. But still, I probably use contiguous loads, right? There's nothing here which says I want to load from potentially different memory locations. And I'm okay with that being less efficient. If I have an efficient load that will load contiguous things, it's great for this example. So questions on that first part? Okay, so then we had here. This example, and we had B, which was this code, and we're asked about whether the instructions were useful for this. So to vectorize this, let's try doing multiple J, and I'm looking at multiple J, this is my first idea because it has better locality than multiple I for A, which is what we're writing to. So like maybe doing it in I might be better, I might have to investigate, but I'm starting with J because I look at this and I say, well, J is the more convenient thing for the values we're writing. That's probably what matters the most. We'll check later. J doesn't work out very well, whether you want to change. So we can expand J, so we can do 4J. And we sort of expand things like don't make off by one errors, like so. And this looks like we have like sort of all the multiplies can be done with vector instructions. Well, so that's not a problem. And then we want to load. I2 plus 0 J through 8192 plus J plus 3. Sort of load a bunch looks good. is good. And similarly, B, same idea. And C, so it looks like sort of the that, you know, we can vectorize this pretty well without that fancy load instruction. We actually just want contiguous loads, seem like they work pretty well. Okay, so then we had here. This code here, and to vectorize this, well, we only have one sort of real option of what to expand in, so we could expand in I, and we get something like this. And we don't have any actual vector operations other than loads and stores here. But the loads we want to load T of I through T of I plus 3. This is great. So this we can use, the load a bunch is good. Then we want to load A of T of I through A of T of I, A of T of I plus 3. And this is not actually, well, that's not actually what we want. We want A of T of I plus 1, A of T of I plus 2, A of T of I plus 3. And these could be A of, you know, anything, you know, A of X and A of X plus, you know, some other number, depending on what T is. Depending on T, right? We don't know. These could be all over the place in A. So load a bunch is not good. And probably we want to use the fancier load instruction for this. We can't easily use that vector load instruction because there's, you know, there's no reason to believe any of the A's are next to each other, even though maybe they could be. And then we had this final option here, where I made an error on the quiz because the original version of the problem had I equals 0 and then multiplied it by 3, and 0 multiplied by 3 is still 0, and that will continue being less than 8,000 forever. So what I meant to write, sort of, was this, in which case we're doing, you know, and we can try to vectorize this. So let's try to expand this into, so I'm just, so we do, so I'm gonna write this out. So we want to do 4 times 3 4 times, so 3 times 3 times 3 times 3. And we'd be doing I times 3, B of I times 3, I times 9, 3 times 3, 3 times 3. And that doesn't, so that's something we could do with vector instructions. There is a multiply that maybe could benefit from vector instructions there. So this multiply, so multiply we could do nicely with vector instructions, but loading and storing is not easy. We want to load A of I times 3, A of I times 3 times 3, etc. You know, load a bunch, sort of the single load from one address instruction won't work. So we want, the fancy load is probably something we could try to use for those. questions? Follow up on that. Okay, and okay, so any other things people want me to talk about? Yes. For the what operators?
Bitwise
operators. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Yeah. Bit masking. Okay. Anything else? So bitwise operators and bit masking. So you should know what the will we expect you to know what bitwise and or XOR and complement. Expect you to know left and right shift and arithmetic versus logical shift. Arithmetic, which is copy sign bit, versus logical at zeros or right shift. And then about bit masking. So bit masking is sort of something we'd like you to know. So it's sort of the when we want to do something with bitwise operators, usually our primary idea is select a few bits, then do something to select a few bits, we usually make a mask which has ones in the selected bits and zeros otherwise, or sometimes, zeros and ones. Sometimes zeros and selected and ones otherwise, depending. We can view sort of bitwise and or XOR as applying a mask. So for example, bitwise and with a mask with ones for the selected bits is keep these bits and clear the non-selected bits. Bitwise XOR with a mask with one for the selected bits is flip these bits and don't change the others. And bitwise OR is set these bits regardless of what they were before. And we can view all the bitwise operators in this kind of way. And sort of the other half, and in addition to selecting bits, we often want to move bits to particular places. Sort of often we'll use bit shifting to do this after selecting the bits with a mask. With a mask and. So and is keep certain bits. So if we want to get bits to a particular place, we can select them with the bitwise and. I guess I'll grant this step. So we'll select the bits, select to keep those bits with a mask and bitwise, and then use bit shifting to move those bits to a particular part of the number, the particular part of our results. So that's the sort of bit masking, most common bit masking pattern by a big margin. Other questions about? Yeah. Should we expect the exam to take up 3 hours? So I'm expecting the exam length to be somewhat less. So I'm expecting the exam to be somewhat less than 130 points, where a typical multiple choice question is 4 points, with four options is 4 points. So, you know, that would mean that if you take 4 minutes to answer such a multiple choice question, it would take you about 2 hours. So I'm hoping it will fit comfortably, and this looks like probably means shorter than the fall 2021 exam by a little bit. But obviously question difficulty can make that vary, and I am not amazing at guessing how long people will take for exams. Yeah. Question, would I say it's all going to be multiple choice? No. But when thinking about how many points questions are, I like think of like how many multiple choice questions should this be equivalent to, sort of things. Well, like things like the quiz question should it be equivalent to, is what I would think. But it will definitely not be all multiple choice, so there'll be some random numerical answer questions and things like that. But I'm kind of guessing that, like, so, but usually I guess like a select all and apply question with four options is usually about the same time as write a single number and so on. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so see you on Friday. The exam location is on the course website. So it is not here. Do not come here. Have a good rest of your semester. Oh, yes.
Is it on Saturday?
It's on Saturday, yes, at 7 p.m.